there are savings and efficiencies staring us in the face in hospitals today. The challenge is for leaders to get behind smoothing patient flow. There's some jargon to get used to for sure, but mastering the methods and the improvement science of patient flow is worth every penny, every dollar, I should say, and we're going to hear why on today's edition of WIHI. Welcome, everyone. I'm Madge Kaplan, your host and producer, and IHI's Director of Communications. WIHI is our free audio talk show with edge, as in cutting edge. And through discussion, most of all, we get the word out about promising innovations that we hope will continue to move a reform agenda forward. When there's so much hand-wringing right now about where to find money to pay for anything new with our healthcare system, such as expanding health insurance coverage, it's critical that we are reminded of the savings that can be generated by doing the right thing, of all things, for patients and providers alike. I have experts and leaders with me today who have the evidence. Let me introduce my guests, and they each have rich experience. You can read more about them on the WIHI web pages on IHI.org. But in brief, Jim Anderson is President and Chief Executive Officer of Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center in Cincinnati, Ohio. A bit of trivia, that's where I was born and raised. Jim has held this position since 1996, where he's been instrumental in shaping the extraordinary growth at the medical center, and he's been a part of an unfolding story of improvement and safety that often has the hospital in the news these days. Jim is joining us by phone. Welcome, Jim Anderson. Eugene Litvak is a familiar faculty name to many of you. He is the president and CEO of the Institute for Healthcare Optimization and professor at the BU School of Management. He also teaches an operations management course as an adjunct professor of operations management in the Department of Health Policy and Management, Harvard School of Public Health. Eugene is a close colleague and neighbor, and he's with us here in the studio. Welcome, Eugene.
Thank you.
All right. And we also have Scott Hamlin with us. Scott is the CFO, as in Chief Financial Officer at Cincinnati Children's. He's in the pilot seat with Jim Anderson today. They're both joining us on the phone from Cincinnati. Scott is the hospital's Senior Vice President of Finance and Corporate Treasurer, as well as CFO. And these are positions he's held since 1997. Now, he's been keeping a close eye on the benefits of improving patient flow, and we're very pleased to also have him with us on the program. So welcome, Scott. So here's what's going to happen. As we do on every WIHI, we're going to spend just about 15, 20 minutes getting the lay of the land, and then we're going to open up for your questions and comments. And a reminder that we keep really good track of a lot of the resources or references that are made during the program, and we've got a resource document in the making that we post to the website after the program, so rest assured you don't have to spend a lot of your chat time tracking down resources or posting your email address. We'll make sure that we get everything to you. And I also want to make a special note at the outset of a link that's now on the homepage of IHI.org as we speak. Eugene Litvak has edited, and Joint Commission Resources has just published a brand new book on patient flow in hospitals, and JCR made the chapter on Cincinnati Children's available for free on our website. It's a great document to have on hand that will help reinforce and everything you learn about today. There are also some other case studies in the book. And I'm sure Eugene will remind us of some of those other exemplar organizations today. All right, so we're going to start off right away. Thank you for letting me get all that out. We've got almost 600 of you with us. Keep them coming. You're welcome at any time. So I'm going to start off with some sort of headline ideas that I seek from each of you. So Jim Anderson, let's warm up the program with some headlines. Not too many details yet, but from your perch of hospital CEO, what are the two or three things that every executive should have on their priority to-do list right now? And I'm wondering, is smoothing patient flow one of them? Jim?
Well, clearly, the overriding one is to run a better business, run a better operation, focused on delivering for us better outcomes, better patient and family experience, and better value. And the notion of being able to do that without concentrating on flow is just not realistic. Flow is such a vital part of all that we do. We operate very complex organizations that require lots of pieces to come together at the right time and the right amount at the right place. And unless we understand the complexities associated with that, flow will break down. And if we can focus on flow and develop a very robust way of reliable processing of our workflow, life will be a great deal better for patients, families, and even CFOs.
All right. I think we could boil that down into a great headline. Eugene, I need to ask you, what are we talking about with the smoothing patient flow, kind of in a nutshell, and why are you so enthusiastic about it?
We are talking about smoothing patient flow for a few reasons. First of all, how the patient flow, hospital census rather, looks today? It looks like swings up and down, and those swings, if the hospital is well managed or lucky, you name it, the difference between two neighboring days between peaks and valleys could be as low as 30-25% or as high as 80%. What does it mean? When you have a peak, your nurse is stressed, and there is no way you can prevent medical errors when your nurses are overloaded, as it's well known. Your emergency department is overcrowded. You don't have too many beds available, and you don't have places to discharge your patients from the ED. Your hospital, in fact, becoming like a parking lot, and you have all the problems together. So in my opinion, smoothing patient flow is not sufficient, but absolutely necessary step in today's hospital.
All right. Well, Jim Anderson, let's dig in. Does that, Eugene use the word parking lot? I dare say you probably wouldn't refer to Cincinnati Children's that way, but what kinds of problems were you facing in the hospital when you began to think about maybe some new ways to go about it?
Well, the central problem we were experiencing in that period, which is really the decade that we are currently winding down, is a growing number of patients and the need to take care of them. In our own experience, they came from an increasingly broad geographic area, and our revenue growth rate for the last 10 years has averaged about 15%. And in that kind of a growth environment, you simply can't build fast enough and can't afford to build fast enough to accommodate patients, increased number of patients at the level and a rate that you need to. So it was fairly obvious that in order to do what we wanted to do for patients, we needed to find better ways of processing our work and addressing flow. The consequences of increased patients and inadequate capacity included parking lot-like experiences, which obviously were not consistent with what we aspired to. But it also, and I think in some ways more importantly, resulted in care that was clearly suboptimal in terms of having children in beds where the staff was not well equipped to deal with the complexities that they were dealing with, in having children come out of the operating room but not have an ICU bed available for them when one was pretty clearly required, and a whole series of consequences which very directly affect the quality of the outcome that we were delivering. And that was fundamentally just not acceptable. And so among the things we began to look at was whether or not we could get better utilization out of our resources, physical, intellectual, technological, the full range, to produce a more consistent, reliable, safer, efficient, and effective experience for patients, delivering a better outcome, better experience, and better value.
All right. Well, at some point, we're going to kind of fast. This is great, Jim. Thank you so much. And we're going to have to sort of fast forward this story. I do invite people to kind of read more of the details in the link that, if you get to the link that's on our website right now. But it's Jim, you and Eugene Litvak, there's probably an interesting backstory how everybody got together. But there you are, and Eugene Litvak is presenting some new ideas. I'm sure he was at Cincinnati Children's more than once. And I'm curious, first I want to ask you, did what he have to say make sense to you right off the bat? And then I'm going to ask if there were any skeptics in the room.
It did make sense to me off the bat. Part of my checkered past includes a stint at an industrial manufacturing company where process quality, statistical process control, all of that kind of stuff was borderline theology, and it was simply the vocabulary of daily work. And the fact that when I got into healthcare, there was very little attention to that whole area surprised me, and I kept looking for a reason why that was appropriate, and obviously had trouble finding one, and ran into Eugene. We were expecting him when we actually first met, and I don't exactly recall, but I do recall a first meeting here at Cincinnati Children's when Eugene came out as we were beginning to sort of test each other out as to whether or not we would engage him on a major project to address flow. And I think he came into that quite skeptical. We came in wondering.
So Eugene was the skeptic. Okay. We'll find out why.
We were both skeptical.
Okay.
And so we sort of butted heads for a while and reached the conclusion that we'd give this a shot, and it's really been wonderfully successful.
Well, all great relationships probably begin with butting heads. I'm going to ask Eugene what he had to say, but Scott Hamlin, were you in the room, and were you a skeptic?
I think it's pretty fair to say I was a skeptic. I think I've been in the industry too long, I guess, that I think you grow up with the idea that you can focus on the patient's needs or you can focus on the physicians who bring the patients to you and their needs. And I think you end up falling into this trap of believing that those are mutually exclusive things. And I think my skepticism was I was hearing in what Eugene was talking about, and obviously no one is so thick as to not think that improving the efficiency of the throughput of any production activity isn't going to be good for the bottom line. But I think, sadly, I have to confess that I wondered if it would be the right thing to attract the surgeons to bring their cases here, or in our cases, we employ our surgeons, it would be what would lead to a high satisfaction. A lot of our flow issues happen as a result of sub-optimizing each division's needs or accommodating an individual physician's preference because they're crucial to your work or to your activities.
Right.
And I wondered if flow and spreading out those activities and planning for them better wasn't going to translate into the surgeons not working at the time they thought was optimal or providing the things that that made for their life and their satisfaction. And it didn't take very long to find out, and I'm embarrassed to admit that I had that thought process, but it didn't take long to figure out that flow is one of those things, one of those magical things where doing the right thing operationally is the right thing for the family, is the right thing for the surgeons, and is the right thing for the CFO, the profitability of the organization.
Thank you. Very interesting. No embarrassment here at all. All right, Eugene, what did you say? Sounds like you had to win over some hearts and minds, but what did you say? What was your convincing argument?
Yeah, I would say that this suspicion and concerns were mutual. And they were mutual for the simple reason. My experience in visiting other hospitals was that they need 100% consensus on making any steps. As one of my colleagues said about one hospital that we visited, he said the vote 99-1 considered to be a tight vote at this place. So it was very important for me to see any commitment on the hospital side. And I remember we presented to the to Jim and his cabinet presented our first findings at the hospital. And there was a group of surgeon, chief of surgery, chief of anesthesia, everybody, all the leaders at the hospital. And when they asked us, they finally decided that we might be the right one to get engaged with, and they asked us to do that. I remember my first reaction was no. And when Jim asked me why not, I said, because these very people, I see the skepticism in their eyes, and I know that they would push back. And what I heard immediately from Jim is Eugene, he interrupted my passionate explanation, and he said, Eugene, you're not going to talk us out of this project. And I publicly announced myself a PI for that.
Okay.
So, of course, after these words, I was defeated, and we immediately agreed, and I'm so happy we did it. Cincinnati, in terms of the leadership, in terms of its problem, I would say Cincinnati is one of the good, definitely the good hospital that we initially met. Now, I mean, it's outstanding. In terms of its leadership, I would say it was outstanding from scratch.
Okay. Well, let me do this. Let me, first of all, remind everybody that this is WIHI. That was Eugene Litvak you were just listening to. Jim Anderson and Scott Hamlin are on the phone from Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. I'm Madge Kaplan, and we are talking about patient flow. And, Jim, let me, well, actually, I'm going to do this. Eugene, I keep asking Eugene to tell me some things in a nutshell, because there's so much we could talk about here. What would you say were some of the guiding principles of what you wanted to have introduced at Cincinnati Children's?
Yeah, what we wanted is not to have as many and as high peaks and valleys in hospital bed occupancy. As Feller, author of the textbook on probability theory, once said, we visited the restaurant, ordered the chicken, I ate the whole chicken, you ate nothing in the average, we ate half of it. So when we're talking about the average census, it's absolutely not informative. When we look at the peaks, then when all the safety problems take place, and there is no way to avoid it. If nurse takes care of 8 patients instead of 4, there is no trick, there is no methodology that would allow you to avoid medical errors. So that was very critical. In terms of ED overcrowding, the same, et cetera, et cetera. So the main goal was to make sure that we will slash the peaks as much as we can and fill up the valleys. And the idea was to drill deep and figure out how many of those peaks and valleys are patient-driven and how many of them are driven by individual priorities that Jim and Scott just mentioned.
And of the surgeons.
Of the surgeons.
And
here is a great opportunity for me to demystify the idea that that's how to improve hospital operations on the back of surgeons. I would say surgeons and their patients are the first and the main beneficiaries of this project.
Okay. All right. So, Jim, why don't you just tick off a couple of things? So what areas of the hospital began to basically undergo some changes?
Well, there were a wide number of them, in part because we got engaged in process improvement projects broadly, stimulated in significant part by the Pursuing Perfection grant that IHI was the program manager for from Robert Wood Johnson that was awarded in 2001. And so out of our commitment in the strategic plan we did that year where we talked about transformational change as being something we wanted to embrace and stimulate across the institution, with that commitment, shortly thereafter, the Pursuing Profession grant and the stimulus associated with that, we began broadly looking at processes that weren't working very well. And things like time to third next available appointment is one metric. Start time in each OR is another metric. We're now beginning to look at midday start time in each of the ORs. And there are, you know, literally hundreds of metrics like that that we began to collect, and significantly as they relate to flow, through the utilization of Eugene's data processing system and software. And so with the collection of data, it became obvious that there were certain bottlenecks in the aggregate system, one of which was that we mixed emergency cases with scheduled cases, with the result that no cases were predictably undertaken, because there were sufficient number of emergency cases to completely disrupt the flow of scheduled cases. And at Eugene's suggestion, we developed a separation of those streams so that emergency cases had a dedicated OR that could respond to the emergency need, and the scheduled cases were in other ORs that could be reliably scheduled. And in those, we could see the metrics pretty clearly change in terms of the late start or on-time start for each of the cases in those rooms. But those were typical.
That gives us a really great idea. Eugene, it makes me want to ask you, there's so many different concepts I know in operation here, but one critical one that I think Jim is just suggesting has to do with the so-called sort of random and non-random variation. I'm the last person who wants to get back into a class on statistics, but why is that such an important idea, though, in this whole process?
All variabilities are bad, whether they are artificial, whether they are natural, whether they are driven by us or driven by our patients. It's bad. Why it's bad? Imagine that you know exactly that all your patients have the same disease and the same severity. If this is not enough, imagine that they arrive to your hospital every 15 minutes, not 14, not 16. And if this is not enough, imagine also that all your physicians and nurses are equal in their ability to provide quality care. What would be the efficiency of such place? Would be 100%.
Right.
That would be a Toyota product line. The problem with that is that none of my assumptions is correct, that patients have different diseases and different responses to therapies. They break their legs at their convenience, not when we want them to break. And physicians and nurses are different in their abilities to provide quality care. We call it these three types of the variability in our variability methodology. We call it clinical flow and professional. Some of each of them could be driven by patient, which we call natural, and most of it, unfortunately, what we discover, are driven by us. In fact, if you come to your emergency department manager today and you ask, how many admissions will you have through your emergency department 4 weeks from now? Today is Wednesday, 4 Wednesdays from now. Short of the holiday, which is always unpredictable, they would be pretty accurate. Of course, not 100% correct, but they would be pretty accurate in predicting that. Now, you go to your cath lab or your operating room and ask 4 weeks from now how many surgeries you're going to have on Wednesday. You'll never get a reliable answer. That shows that Mother Nature is more predictable than our scheduling system.
Okay, all right. Interesting, very, very intriguing ideas. I'm sure they're familiar to many of you. And in fact, we're going to bring you into the conversation in just a moment. I'm Madge Kaplan. I'm your WIHI host. You were just listening to Eugene Litvak, and Jim Anderson and Scott Hamlin are on the phone from Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. Let's do this. Just before I bring people in, Jim and Scott, why don't the two of you tell us, again, we're sort of fast-forwarding with this story, but what have been some of the standout results and achievements at the hospital as a result of this work, which went on over, perhaps tell us, over how many, what period of time, how many years? Eugene is holding up three fingers here. About that time. Okay. That must sound right to you. Why don't you highlight some of the achievements for us?
We thought we started a lot earlier than that, but we just started.
It's when you were dreaming of this time, right?
I know. Right.
Yeah, right.
Well, among things, the weekday waiting times, there was a 24 or 28% reduction in those, in spite of a 24% increase in case volumes. And this is between 2004 and 2009, so it's a a 5-year period that we've we're measuring here.
Mm-hmm.
Our weekend wait times dropped 34% in spite of a 37% increase in case volume. The throughput increase of cases was 4.8% over that period, or the equivalent of one OR in a setting of 20 operating rooms. And our overtime hours decreased by an estimated 57% between the fall of 06 and the first part of 07. And that saved us about $550,000 annually. So the growth of our caseload in the ORs at 7% was sustained during that period of time for the last 2 years. I'm jumping around in time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And we've added no additional operating rooms. That's sort of the utilization numbers. Let me invite Scott to talk about the dollar numbers.
All right. Scott, our CFO, what happened?
Well, if you don't let me mind my stepping back just for one second.
Okay.
I think it's crucial to understand that you're well aware that Cincinnati, given your history here, is not the largest of cities.
Okay.
And the demographics are such that for a hospital that operates on the scale that we do, requires that patients come to us from an enormous geography. We are the destination for a lot of tertiary care from a great draw area that includes every state and well beyond. And because of that, there are some features in there that I could go on about, but one of the most crucial is that we're competing with lots of other places that will be geographically more convenient for that same patient.
Mm-hmm.
And so our ability to distinguish our product, not just on outcomes and safety, which is crucial. The longer I've been in this, the more I've understood that flow is an integral part, inseparable from any conversation about safety or outcomes improvement. But we also have to focus on the patient's experience. And if you're going to delay yourself or choose us when we're less convenient than another option, then part of our draw has to be that we take you when you're ready for us, not you come to us when we're ready to take you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to give you these numbers that were the global result of the work that Eugene got us embarked on and helped us to understand.
All right.
In 2004, we had 425 beds. And we routinely, predictably, experienced what we would call an operational failure, meaning that a referral from outside our geography or a surgical case was denied because we didn't have a bed ready, or a surgical case was canceled for reasons that were operational and within our control. That happened routinely at 325 patients when we were at 325 beds full. So we had a theoretical capacity of 425 beds if everything was perfect, but we had an operating system that meant capacity was reached at about 76% occupancy, if you were going to measure that by a critical failure. By 2009, fast-forwarding through the work that has been done, in trying to smooth the schedule, separate the streams, eliminate the bottlenecks, better discharge planning, better cohorting of patients, and changes that are really difficult in a pediatric setting because not every bed in our setting, we got newborn nursery beds, and we have beds that take care of very large children with obesity problems that and they're not interchangeable. So it is a very difficult scenario, and we were able over that period of time to get our capacity, our practical capacity, up to 91% of our theoretical capacity.
You're on a par with Canada, by the way. I'm looking at this chart, an OECD acute care bed occupancy that Eugene brought in several countries, and you have now moved from the U.S. average, I guess, of 67% all the way up to Canada there at 90%.
So you actually had a unique opportunity to be at two extremes, U.S. and the very bottom of the bed occupancy and Canada on the very top.
And let me just put that into some dollar terms for you very quickly.
Okay, sure. Yep.
Taking more time. That gave us the capacity to see 78 more patients, which was critical to our business model of we take you when you're ready for us without building. Now, we have to have the demand that fills those, and every day we don't have the demand that utilizes that. So I wouldn't be here pretending that our occupancy is 91%. What I am telling you is that we're capable of operating at a sustained level of 91%, and when we have that activity, a failure or a critical failure, as I defined it, does not occur. That gave us the potential of $375,000 of additional revenue per day when we fill those beds, or $137 million a year if we are able to generate the demand from our programs to fill the capacity that the work created. If we did not do that, we would have had to have built 102 more beds than we currently have if we were still operating at 71% occupancy and trying to accommodate the volume that we handle today. So we probably avoided at least another $100 to $200 million of construction costs while freeing up the capacity to generate over $100 million more in revenue.
All right.
Thank you very much. Let me play devil's advocate here. One may listen to you and say, you got $137 million annually, $100 million in avoided capital cost. Probably the salary of your executives are skyrocketing. How are you spending this money? How the community benefits from that?
Well, we're, as you know, a nonprofit, so the money has to go back into the corporation spent on its purposes. On executive salaries, we actually capped those last year, and none of the senior executives got any increase in salary in, I guess that would have been July of 2009 when our fiscal year began, and we capped lower ranking executives at $3,000 maximum increase. So it clearly didn't go there. Where the money goes for us, the large projects right now are an information technology project where we're converting to the Epic system, which is about, for us, a $50 million capital cost and a comparable operating expense over a several-year period. We have a large research operation there in research, as many of the listeners will know. You have to supply a certain amount of funding in order to compete for NIH grants. They never cover all of the costs, and our unfunded research is about 35% of our aggregate research expenses. The research portfolio is in the $150 million range of external funding for research, and so the ability to cover researchers' costs between NIH grants and as they develop as researchers is an important place we put funds, because we look for a return on that investment out of that, of better ways of treating kids, new knowledge. In some cases, those opportunities turn into products or connections with other institutions engaged in healthcare, but fundamentally, the research is focused on the improvement in what we can deliver as outcomes. And those are kind of the two big places that funding went.
All right. So thank you, Jim. Thank you, Scott. Eugene here. I have a follow-on question to that, but I want to apologize just a little bit to everyone who's tuned in. We definitely have not meant to close you out of the conversation. We're trying to get a lot of stuff out there. I want Jesse to quickly remind everybody how to start chatting in. Go ahead, Jesse.
Thanks a lot, Madge, and I just pulled this up on the screen here. When you are chatting, I'd ask that you send the message to all participants. You can just type your message in that text entry box down at the bottom right-hand corner of your screen and select all participants from that menu. I'm going to jump in with a question because I saw Eugene's eyes light up when it came through. Given that flow through the hospital can be equated to flow of water through a pipe, where do you get started on such a large project? Is it in the ED, discharge planning? There's got to be a ton of
places. All of them. That's very important question. Thank you, Jay. I know that every hospital had their project, ED, ICU, etc., wherever you feel the pain. But let me tell you, where should we start? And I'm pretty confident. We should start with scheduled admission, and the main source of scheduled admission is operating room. If you want to compare it with something, it's like a Vatican. It's a state within a state that acts independently. Now, imagine that I give you all the necessary resources, additional bed, staff, whatever you need in order to improve your ED throughput and admission through the ED. And then you put me in charge of elective admissions. And I can introduce such a high peak in elective admission that I will ruin everything you built. So it shows that whenever you keep a scheduled admission out of the loop, you are not going to achieve your goal.
All right. Thank you. Good place to start. We're getting a lot of questions. Thank you very much. And I just want to have Jim Anderson or Scott tell us literally in 30 seconds. We're aware that you also have been able to do some things regarding Medicaid recipients and the uninsured and underinsured in the Cincinnati area as a result of these changes. Is that true?
That is true. I'm not sure that we did much to make it happen. The economy helped produce a significant increase in our Medicaid load.
Okay.
About half of our patients are either covered by a Medicaid program or need financial assistance of some kind given their financial position. So we were able to absorb that increase or deterioration in the payer mix as a result of the economy. And we've also been able to invest extremely heavily in the provision of mental health services, not something that you would often see a children's hospital or any acute hospital invest in. It's a big area of underserved issues. It's not a profitable area, very difficult to make happen. And I would say our ability to support that program the way healthcare reimbursement works today would probably have been impossible if it weren't for the margin pressure that was released as a result of the flow and quality improvement focus.
Okay, thanks, Scott. One question, I'm going to start, we're going to start picking off some of these questions right now. I also want to invite people, if you feel like it, based on what you heard from Eugene, Scott, and Jim Anderson, we're curious, what would you be ready to start working on and implementing, and what might be stopping you? I was talking to Eugene earlier about data collection, which can be a big stumbling block, and perhaps we'll talk about that more. But Eugene, there's several questions here that are curious about methodology, that they're wondering, does Six Sigma have anything to do with Lean, et cetera, et cetera? So you want to just clarify that?
Yeah, no, actually it's not a Lean and Six Sigma. It's rather the whole system redesign. It's not redesign of the individual units or individual department. Actually, it's going to affect the whole system. This project has three phases. The phase one, as Jim already mentioned, separating schedule and unscheduled. The second, only once you separate, you may smooth elective surgical admissions, because if you do not separate, you cannot smooth unscheduled emerging cases. So that's phase two, is smoothing. And phase three, you calculate how many beds do do you need, or other resources? You know that additional regular MedSurg bed cost hospital over $1 million in capital cost, plus over $250,000 in operational cost annually.
All right. Okay. Thank you. A question about leadership. There's also some questions. Maybe Scott and Jim, you could tell us very quickly about a very important person we had hoped to include in the call. He actually is one of the lead writers on the chapter in the JCR book about Cincinnati Children's, Dr. Fred Reichman, senior surgeon at Cincinnati Children's. Somebody is wondering about leadership and what leadership drove this project. We're hearing about some of it right now on this program with these individuals. Jim, do you want to tell us about this? Or Eugene, you want to tell us about the significance of Dr. Reichman? Or Jim, let's start with you.
I would be glad to. First of all, I think the leadership on this issue as a priority for the institution has to start at the highest levels. I mean, the CEO has to be very clear and overly clear, clearer than the truth, express his or her support for and essential nature of improvement in flow in order to meet patient needs and provide better care to patients. That conclusion has to be supported by the Board of Trustees so that the top leadership piece is unquestionably there, and everyone knows that, and everyone knows there's simply no alternative to that process going forward in a successful way. Secondly, one needs really multiple, but certainly a primary accountable leader in the trenches who knows what life is like in the peri-op arena and has the credibility and personal skills to be persuasive in shepherding these changes. For us, the person we picked was Fred Reichman, who's a transplant surgeon. We sent him to the Brent James program in Salt Lake City as an early conversion experience for him. He became engaged and enthusiastic about process improvement as a way to provide better care. And when he came back, we supported him with a range of principally data collecting and analysis resources. And then Fred, as he began through data to understand flow, began working with Eugene and began engaging with not just the surgeons, but clearly the nurses and the people who say grace over all of the moving parts that have to come together to make peri-op function well. He really became the probably most visible leader of the effort. But it's a multiple
yep.
group of leaders, particularly including nursing at the peri-op level, and everybody has to be on board, and the CEO has a big role to play in reminding everybody they need to be on board and deliver results.
Okay, thank you. You know, as far as there are people have been asking various questions having to do with metrics and the ability to understand some things regarding safety and patient satisfaction. Eugene, were there these kinds of sort of sensitive metrics sort of built in and do they continue?
I do not know. I cannot speak for the hospital. The only questionnaire that we distributed after phase one was a questionnaire among surgeons in anesthesia and nursing related to the OR, whether in their opinion, they, their colleagues and the patients were happy and satisfied with that. I do not want to spend time commenting on that. You go to IHI.org website and you look at the chapter 6 on Cincinnati on the homepage, and it does have this questionnaire, so you can see yourself.
All right. There's a question that also came in about leveling surgical volume. What does that mean?
Yeah, what that means, it means asking surgical subspecialties, not individual surgeons, but rather surgical subspecialty to smooth, to even their flow admissions every day, the case volume for elective surgeries, of course, for elective. Now, why would they do it? Why would they change all of a sudden their behavior? Because they benefit. We found surgeons to be very smart and very data-driven. If you approach them with their own data and show that as a result of that, they're first, let me mention a few carrots. First, throughput is going to be up. over time is going to be down. Their patients are going to be placed in the ICU or their preferred unit, not where you happen to have an empty spot. And as well as turnover time would be reduced because your nurses would know that after performing X cases, they're going to go home. They're not going to be rewarded for extra case. So all these parameters play their role. Besides, we told surgeons that they're not going to be married to this project, that they will try it for a few months, let's say 3 months, and if they're unhappy, they drop it. Of course, you know, once they tried it, they're happy.
All right. What specifically happened in the ED? I think that one of the overriding principles of our program today is that, you know, we no part of the hospital is an island. I don't think we have to sort of say that so much on this program with this group of sophisticated folks tuned in. But there are a lot of improvement projects that focus so much on the ED. In this case, though, the ED was a part of a whole series of transformations. Very quickly, either Eugene or Scott, what changed in the ED that you would say would be most significant?
I can tell you, Jim already quoted the numbers, that it was significant, like 1/3 reduction in the waiting time for emergent and urgent surgeries, despite about one-third of increase in the volume.
All right, thank you. Let's keep going. Scott, you want to add anything to that in terms of the emergency department?
I'll just add a couple of things. I think they all applied the very specifics that Eugene has brought to us. One, we have made significant changes in the triage process. We made significant changes in defining workflows. The flow is about a system-wide approach to segregate streams of activity into a more efficient model and not try to force one type of activity that doesn't fit the most efficient model for the service of that activity. So we separated primary care that was coming into our emergency room from urgent care that was coming in and trauma and emergent, and made sure that there was an expert workflow designed for each of them if we could get the streams of patients into those. And lastly, and this is embarrassing, but it's back to Eugene's point, if you study data and you make it someone's passion to make inferences from that data, simple things in RED that are unbelievable for me to confess, that we did not try to match the peaks in demand with peaks in staffing. We staff on a normal routine basis of the way you do shifts, but that's not the way peaks in demand predictably come into an ED, and we did nothing to accommodate the reality. We did everything to accommodate the way shift work works. And those were just a few of the examples of things that happened in the ED that made things happen different in the OR, which made things happen different in the recovery room, and so on and so forth as it cascades through.
All right. Thank you so much, Scott. I'm going to ask Eugene in just a second to give our participants today, who knows, even a little bit of homework. But Eugene actually created some sort of neat slides here, and this one that he's showing me has to do with what the opportunity is. Why don't you tick some of these off for us? Okay.
What I would like to say, we have a few very interesting numbers. The average hospital bed occupancy in the United States, according to OECD, is 65, and according to AHA, American Hospital Association, is about 65-67%. The next closest to us is France with 73, but we are on the bottom of all industrialized nations, and Canada is a 90, and everybody is giving Canada as an example why patients wait so long for surgery. Cincinnati Children's had a higher bed occupancy, and patients do not wait for surgery. So that's not because of the Canadian system. So our hospitals are in the average 65% bed occupancy and yet are overcrowded. Why? Because of those peaks. So what should be bed occupancy? The bed occupancy, and that could be scientifically proven, not just guesstimated, could be 80% plus 80% plus. Cincinnati has more than 90. So we have 15% difference between what we have currently and where we should be. And this 80-plus percent up to 90-plus would not be accompanied by overcrowding or medical errors. What does it mean? What is the proportion of uninsured in a country? It's about 14-15%. So it means that we would cover all uninsured hospital medical costs of all uninsured admissions at the hospital. Overall, if every hospital in the United States would absorb, do what Cincinnati did, and would absorb only 10% of what they absorb, that would be exactly the amount of money, $837 billion in 10 years, sufficient for our health care reform.
All right. Well, thank you. Some very bold numbers. And the folks who joined WIHI do not miss a beat, and they're wondering about these slides of yours, Eugene. And Eugene brought them with us today, and we didn't have time to kind of load them in, but we will have them available on the resource document, so I promise you that. You can look for all of that later today or first thing tomorrow morning. We have a wonderful document that Vicki Minden puts together. I have kind of something I want to tell people about, which has Eugene's involvement in it. But Eugene, while I'm digging out this that piece of paper, tell people, we discussed the fact that you've got to get the data right, though. You cannot start building a whole change process if we haven't quite figured out what everyone is talking about and what the measurement is. For folks who were on our program today, what kinds of things could they start working on now to begin to sort of tune up what it is that even know about their hospital that would put them in a good position to start implementing
things? I would definitely start with a few things. I would start in measuring what is your waiting time between the surgery, when the surgery is booked, and when the incision took place. You might be surprised that at most of the hospitals, they do not collect any data, and while we are saying that we are trying to reduce that time, we do not know even what it is. So what you have to do is to start in measuring this time. In order to measure it, you have to start collecting the data on your booking time and the case volume performed for different days. Try to find average number of surgeries performed on different weekdays, and you will see this is what we called weekday disease. All of a sudden, you'll find that on a particular day, patients all of a sudden become thicker at your hospital, and on Thursday, you have a higher case volume than all other days. That's enough of a sign to show that something fishy is going on. This couple of data points I would start collecting right away.
Somebody's asked a question about dirty data, and did you have to clean up dirty data?
Yes. I'm sorry. There are two people. One is Dr. Reichman that had been mentioned, another Dr. Uma Katagal, that they were kind of engine for this project.
Yes.
And Fred Reichman, now when we present at different meetings, he said, when I've heard another 1,001st request from a data for cleaning the data from you, I wanted to throw the telephone in your head.
All right.
So that's very important. The clean data is everything.
Okay. All right. Well, good question there. I want to just very quickly say, and then I'm going to have everybody get in some last words here. If you're interested in getting involved in this kind of improvement we're talking about today, we do have some interesting programs coming up with Dr. Litvak. All additional information is available on IHI.org. But he's going to be leading a 12-month engagement focused on optimizing OR throughput and efficiency by redesigning patient flow, everything we're talking about today. And that program begins in February. And then there's a professional development program. We've been talking a lot about leadership here called Managing Hospital Operations. It's training for individuals who are interested in learning and applying the tools and methods of management sciences. And we see how relevant that is. Both these programs begin in February. There's information on IHI.org. And, this is the kind of teaching and learning. And as you can tell, Eugene is passionate. And I think some of this stuff, might start to give people a headache. But we hope today's program begins to see what real difference it makes. And I guess what I'd like to do now, Scott and Jim, and first of all, I want to also thank you, Scott, because I understand you rearranged your schedule to make yourself available for the full hour. Give us some sort of parting words. As always, we cannot begin to get to everything today. I'm going to have to put my head together with my WIHI team. We've got a lot of questions on chat today, and we'll see if we can't find some ways to answer some of your questions, although a nice participant reminded everybody that a lot of questions can get answered, actually, in that nice JCR chapter that we have. So that's a big help. But maybe, Scott and Jim, very quickly, what would your advice be? Eugene gave some pointers for maybe what folks can do to sort of get going on data. You've both made very, very strong cases for what you're up to. Jim talked a lot about leadership. Any advice, any pitfalls, something that you might share with people that they don't have to waste their time on, or what would be kind of some of your go for it kind of words for our participants today?
I would start by really a couple comments. One is that while we've talked a lot about peri-op OR flow, the same principles hold true for the entire hospital, inpatient, outpatient, non-surgical, mental health, all aspects of services that places like ours offer. So while these principles are today really focused on the OR, think more broadly than that, and it's an opportunity I think healthcare has in virtually every aspect of the service it, it delivers. Secondly, I agree with Eugene completely that, that the place to start is data collection. And I think once you start in that, and I would also say just do it. Get started. Quit, you know, thinking about it and start gathering sensible data that describes what's happening, and learn from that, and then go on to the next step and the next step and the next step, and improvement with energy behind it will occur. So I think what we need nationally is data collection internally, but leadership courage to start gathering it. Life will not be perfect. We all need to just get in there and wrestle with it. Sometimes it's dirty, sometimes it's not, but only through work, tenacity, and absolute determination to get actionable data will these changes occur. And it'll take more time than you want it to. There will be pushback, as we've experienced and others have, but tenacity and continuity of purpose in getting good data to drive change is essential. So short advice, start with data collection, go for it, use common sense, never give up, and just keep pushing.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Jim and Scott. Eugene, you're going to get the last word in here, and there were so many things that we could talk about, and I have a feeling Eugene's going to maybe be so helpful to us around some of trying to answer some of these questions that flew up with chat. Anything on the policy front that would make a difference as you look around right now? I mean, Jim is essentially saying, you know, dig in where you are right now. We've got some big things still percolating for sure on Capitol Hill, but are there any policy changes that would make a difference?
I would say that, in my opinion, hospitals should be incentivized for keeping their census above 80%. That would put them in much better financial situation, would improve safety if they do what Cincinnati Children's did, and that would help achieving our national goal. By the way, if you're interested in looking at the leapfrog, they already, less than a month ago, they put on their website some initiative that they're going to reward the hospitals that do that.
All right, exactly, leapfrog, and we have that on our resource page as well. Thank you so much, Eugene. Well, I can't believe how this hour sped by. I want to thank our guests, Scott Hamlin, Jim Anderson from Cincinnati Children's, Eugene Litvak, here with me in the studio. Please check out our website later today or first thing tomorrow morning. We'll have an audio download of this program. You can also find it on iTunes. We'll have a wonderful resource document. When you get off and log off today's program, you can download the chat as well and the slides that we did have, and we'll also make sure those other slides are available. Please take a moment to fill out a brief survey that's going to pop up. We want to know what worked for you today, what maybe didn't, what we can continue to do to make better. Like what we've been talking about today, we want to continue to improve WIHI. Any questions at all, you can email us at info@ihi.org. Very quickly on the next WIHI, that's on December 17th, a week after our national forum. We do hope we'll see many of you there, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We are clicking on the electronic medical record with several experts and first-hand adopters, and we're going to see what those physician notes are all about and what it's like for patients and providers alike to have access to them, I should say, and I do hope you'll join us for that program. I want to say that it has been my sincere pleasure so far hosting this program throughout 2009. I'm really, really looking forward to 2010. We have one more program in December, and I hope you will continue to be avid listeners and participants and tell people about it. The people who make this program possible are Jonathan Small, Mike Sweeney, Jesse McCall, Alan Olison, Jane Rossner, and Vicki Minden. Wonderful people, Patricio and Jennifer Batayas, and we've got Aaron Flanders and Miguel Safasoa, and they have been helping us out with music on this program. It's my privilege, my sincere privilege, to host a program that's about spirited learning and improving patient care, most of all, for the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. I'm Madge Kaplan. Thanks for tuning in today. Good day, everyone.